This week on Making Contact. August 29th, 1970. 30,000 people, mostly Chicanos, peacefully demonstrated against the disproportionate number of Latinos dying on the front lines in Vietnam. Chicanos were calling for a moratorium on the war, but the 3-mile march and rally to Laguna Park wasn't only about that. People came from as far as Texas, New Mexico, and New York to also protest substandard education, racism, police violence, and other issues negatively affecting Latinos. Tongva elder Gloria Arellanes is a former Brown Beret and one of the moratorium organizers.
It was a beautiful day weather-wise. The crowds were amazing.
Chicano moratorium organizer Rosalio Munoz.
It was a wondrous event. It was like a moving fiesta down the main commercial center of East Los Angeles.
And there was something going on that made me go up on the stage, and all I could see at the back of the park was like a wave, people just coming in and then moving out and then coming back again, and then all hell broke loose.
What started out as a peaceful demonstration of students and families ended with an attack on the crowd by riot-clad police, 400 arrests and the deaths of 4 people, one of whom was Los Angeles Times journalist Ruben Salazar. But the August 29th Chicano moratorium wasn't simply a march and rally that turned violent. It became a turning point in the Chicano civil rights movement and left a stain on Los Angeles that after half a century still hasn't gone away. This is Frontline East LA, the Chicano moratorium 50 years later, on Making Contact. I'm Monica Lopez. LA was a very different place in 1970. For one thing, Latinos, mostly Mexican Americans, made up 13% of the city's population. Today it's about half. Few held political office. Instead, they wielded their power through their activism. In the summer of 1970, the Chicano civil rights movement had reached a high point, and Latinos were marching en masse for peace and social change.
One of our slogans was, "Our war is here. Our front line is here, not in Vietnam. Our front line is in the struggle for social justice at home."
Rosalio Munoz traveled to dozens of U.S. cities to speak about the importance of Chicanos creating a peace movement of their own.
It was called Chicano Moratorium because that fall of 1969, there were major demonstrations. One that went going on all over the country in 50 to 100 cities, and a couple of million people or more demonstrated, including a lot of Chicanos.
And yet, Chicano activists knew the full picture about Latino casualties was not being reported. Nearly everyone I spoke to for this story used the term cannon fodder to describe the military's treatment of Chicano soldiers. Political scientist Dr. Ralph Guzman found that while Mexican Americans made up only about 10% of the population in the Southwest, they were a staggering 19.4% of casualties in Vietnam.
The farm workers were organizing farm workers, the leaders of walkouts for a higher, better education. They were fighting for better education. The ones fighting for against gerrymandering and to register voters, they were doing that. But we needed people that would focus on organizing against the war and nationally.
The Brown Berets of East LA were instrumental in calling for a Chicano moratorium. Local and national media were on site to cover it.
On August 29th, I was an associate producer at television station KCET in Los Angeles.
Jesus Trevino and his sound recordist Henry Rangel wrapped up their coverage of the rally at Laguna Park and headed back to their car. It was near the entrance to the sheriff's substation.
And we were unloading the equipment into my car when all of a sudden we heard this incredible wailing of sirens, and these cars started emerging from the parking lot. There must have been, I think I counted something like 35 different cars that whizzed by. And they were going so fast that we had to flatten ourselves up against the cars or else we would be hit. And in each of these sheriff's patrol cars, there were 4 or 5 or even 6 officers jammed in there with full riot gear.
Trevino found out later that someone at a liquor store near the park had called the police to report a stolen six-pack of beer.
20 minutes earlier, and it had been a peaceful march. And I did the math. I said, well, how long does it take to get 35 cars full of sheriffs with their uniforms and everything else together and organize? And it was evident to me that they must have been waiting there for hours, perhaps. And I think when the call came in about the Green Mill liquor store, that was the pretext they were waiting for.
UCLA history professor Juan Gomez-Quinones wrote that 500 police officers and sheriff's deputies joined the melee that day. When it was all over, 400 people had been arrested and four were dead, including LA Times journalist and KMEX news director Ruben Salazar. Salazar was killed when LA County Sheriff's Deputy Tom Wilson fired a projectile into the Silver Dollar Cafe. The canister struck the reporter in the head. Gloria Arellanes recalls that the deaths of Lynn Ward, Angel Gilbert Diaz, Gustav Montag, and Ruben Salazar overshadowed the issues behind the moratorium.
Then, of course, the whole thing, what became the issue was the death of Ruben Salazar. You know, a news reporter, a well-liked man. He just went in there for beer. And how does somebody shoot through a curtain and get him? He's sitting at a bar. That means they didn't announce. They just shot that canister in there.
Documentary filmmaker Jesus Trevino.
Tempers were pretty high, and they were fearful that there was going to be another riot, that the community would explode again. And so the authorities all agreed that they should convene a blue ribbon panel made up of community members.
Members like clergy and community activists who could lend credibility to the coroner's inquest into Ruben Salazar's death. People like Irene Tovar, who currently sits on the City of LA's Human Relations Commission.
I guess to placate us, they created the inquest. And basically, it was most of us who had been the organizer. And our role was really nothing. We would go there every day, and then they would be interviewing the sheriffs and the LAPD. And our role was to sit there and observe.
And as it turned out, many of these people wound up walking away from it because they felt they were being used.
The following clip was taken from a 1970 documentary film about the moratorium, Requiem 29. In the film, hearing officer Norman Pitluck ask Raul Ruiz whether he saw people breaking police car windows. Ruiz was a staff photographer for the Chicano newspaper La Raza.
Would you describe the individual you saw throwing the article or articles at police car windows?
Wow.
If you know.
No, that's really impossible.
All right. Do you have any photographs in your collection of individuals who did break police car windows?
No, I don't.
Do you have any photographs in your collection of broken police windows? Police car windows?
I would imagine I do have.
Do you have them with you?
No, I don't.
Did you personally see any windows broken, any stores or shops along Whittier Boulevard?
I saw windows broken on Whittier Boulevard, not at the time that they were being broken. I observed that they were broken, as I passed through Whittier Boulevard.
Do you know of what type of item was used to break the windows? If you know.
No.
Did you see any particular individuals who were breaking windows?
I think I answered that question already.
Well, if the answer is no, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I answered that question already. I told you already before that I...
Well, that was in connection with police windows. This is in connection with store windows.
Well, in connection with store windows, the previous question that you asked me, did I observe any individuals, and I had said no. I told you that I observed windows were already broken when I passed or saw them.
All right. Do you have any pictures of any individuals in that connection? Any pictures of anyone breaking a window?
Well, if we follow the logic of the questions that you're asking me, I told you that the windows that I did see were already broken. Of course, how would I be able to see the...
All right.
On August 29th, Salazar was seated with colleagues inside the Silver Dollar Bar and Cafe. They were further down Whittier Boulevard, about 2 miles away from the attack by police at the park. At the inquest, then L.A. County Deputy Sheriff Tom Wilson describes what he did at the entrance to the Silver Dollar Cafe.
I made the decision to fire tear gas. When I approached the doorway, I knew I had a tear gas projectile in the weapon. I didn't know whether I had a long-range missile or whether I had a flight right. It really wouldn't make that much difference to me. The reason for using a flight right or a tumbler would be to get inside the location. But I wanted to get something inside, and I wanted to get it inside quick.
Wilson shot a 9.5-inch long tear gas canister into the bar, which struck the journalist in the head and killed him. Filmmaker Jesus Trevino.
The inquest was not about the death of Ruben Salazar and who had killed him. The inquest was a pretext to vilify the Chicano community, to portray the Chicano community as a group of radicals that had from the very beginning set their mind to destroying and to attacking the police. And then they tried to find any evidence they could to support this.
So they went through the showcase coroner's inquest. It was a divided vote, as I understand. Then the district attorney, Evel J. Younger, decided not to file any charges.
Felix Gutierrez is emeritus professor at USC Annenberg School of Journalism.
Ruben Salazar was the only person who could speak with authority and credibility to both the Anglo, or general population, and the Spanish-speaking population through his LA Times work and then his column. And he also, because of being news director of Spanish language TV station KMEX, spoke directly to the Latino community. So he was a bridge. He was a bridge between two very divided worlds in those days. So silencing his voice was a devastating move toward interracial, intergroup, interethnic understanding. For the Spanish-speaking audience, he led a significant news organization, and it showed that, if you speak out or speak up too much, you might end up paying a price. I don't know that it was directly, but I'm sure that if the news director of one of the English language stations had been killed the way Salazar was killed by a sheriff's deputy, there would have been more of an inquest, more of a serious attention to what happened.
The LA County Sheriff's Department historian declined to comment for this story on Ruben Salazar's death or the investigation that followed. You're listening to Frontline East LA on Making Contact. Making Contact is offered for free to stations across the country and around the world. Check us out on Twitter and Instagram or wherever you get your podcasts. Our handle is making_contact. And now back to Frontline East LA, the Chicano moratorium 50 years later. On August 29, 1970, some 30,000 people demonstrated against the disproportionate number of Latinos dying on the front lines in Vietnam.
And let me tell you, it was an ocean of people. You could hear them coming and coming and coming.
But this Chicano moratorium against the war was built on the foundations of years of organizing for social change on many different fronts. That's how Irene Tovar began working on behalf of the community. She got started by working to improve education for Spanish-speaking children.
In the sense that we were united, we felt good about each other because we united against an injustice. That was the good part of it. But at the same time, we were acknowledging the tragedy of the casualties that were occurring in our community, especially since we were denied all these things. And the reason I tell you about the education, how we were involved, because that was one of many other issues that throughout the Southwest we were complaining or protesting about. The issue of our children's education, the lack of the punishment because of our culture, our language.
In 2001, Tovar was honored by the U.S. Congress for her decades of service in empowering Latinos in California. One of her earliest projects was establishing the first educational Head Start program in the San Fernando Valley section of Los Angeles. A few years prior to that, Tovar and her community took it upon themselves to support Spanish-speaking children in school.
Between 1962 and 1965, roughly, we raised money. We sold enchiladas, we had bake sales, whatever, to pay a bona fide preschool teacher to come twice a week and teach children 600 words in English and other early child development skills, okay? Preparing them for elementary, because at that time, again, the local schools had corporate punishment if you spoke Spanish. In my elementary school, the practice was that if the child was heard speaking Spanish in the classroom, in the hallway, in the playground, you were punished. And for usually the girls, you went in front of the classroom and you extended your hand out and the teacher would ask you, Margarita, why are you being punished? And Margarita, very shy, very frightened, would say, because I spoke Spanish. So what the teacher would do, get the ruler and hit the little girl on the hand. And that was, can you just imagine a young child being humiliated in front of their fellow student, okay, problem. So we wanted to address that. We wanted children to feel comfortable when they entered at least 600 words in English.
It was experiences like these, whether it was the shaming of a child's first language, a lack of opportunity in the workplace, or having a higher probability of finding yourself on the front lines in Vietnam, that drew Latinos to the moratorium. At the same time, Chicano activists and journalists say they were being surveilled and increasingly scrutinized. In this clip from the film Requiem 29, Raul Ruiz tells hearing officer Norman Pitluck about his newspaper's experience with L.A. County sheriffs after the protest.
Would you bring a complete set of your pictures to this session this afternoon?
That is impossible.
Is that because you can't get your hands on them or something?
That's right.
Where are they now?
Most of our negatives, simply because we believe that the sheriffs were going to raid us, since the day before La Raza was published, the sheriffs were all over our office. At that point, in one point, the sheriffs did try to come into our office. And at this point, one of our lawyers stopped the sheriffs from coming into the office and asked them just what they were trying to do. And at this point, the sheriff retreated back into the squad cars. They questioned some of the people that were outside. They searched some of the people. They searched the cars and what have you. And this was on a half-hour basis at our office. Anybody coming in or going out was stopped. And so therefore, you know, as far as the work that was being done photographically, we could not take that chance of having the sheriffs come and steal our property. So therefore, you know, it was removed from the area.
Well, and where are the negatives now?
Well, wow. You know, I don't understand, you know, this line of questioning, whether it is from you or whether it is from the prosecutor or whoever, you know, as to what it has to do, you know, with the inquest of Ruben Salazar.
It's been 50 years since the events that transpired on August 29th, 1970. And the investigation into Ruben Salazar's death remains officially unresolved. Still, there was a backlash that people suffered through and a culture of surveillance to navigate, or at least the threat of it. Irene Tovar.
I'll tell you, some of our meetings were packed with people, but we knew who was who, okay? The East LA people knew who they were, and so we could identify just by... We never confronted, to my knowledge, we never confront them, but we knew it, and we would announce it in our meetings. We know that there are some undercover people here, so they we wanted them to know that we knew that they were there and hearing everything. And we had nothing that we were hiding from them. We were legitimately exercising our amendment rights under the Constitution. And so we were very open about it. So we were harassed before, during, and after. After maybe a little bit more, it was just as harassment, just as painful, just as ugly, just as efforts to put fear in us. For me, it didn't do that. It made me more determined that in whatever way I could, as one individual, that I was going to fight anything that resembled this ever again. It made me so determined because I had seen it. We had planned it. We had legitimate concerns like any other citizen to protest the war that was really taking our young men in large, in ridiculous proportion to our population, and then denied our rights in education and employment and housing, every aspect that constitute our society. We had not been giving our dues. We were there, but we were not visible.
In 5 decades, progress has certainly been made in politics and labor and education. For the first time, the majority of the University of California 2020 freshman class are Latinos. Comparing Latinx representation in politics and media to 50 years ago, Felix Gutierrez acknowledges that we've made significant progress. But when considering the population size of Latino communities and their issues, there's still a long way to go.
Compared to 50 years ago, we've made significant progress. Compared to where we are today in terms of the population size and issues and understanding, we still have a long way to go. People know who we are. People do recognize our existence, something that I think they did not always before. But the level of understanding, I think, is still not there. We have more celebrities than we did 50 years ago, sports stars, politicians who play significant roles. But the day-to-day Latino events, I think, are still separated into problem people and zoo stories. We're either people who are beset or causing problems for others, or we're on display, like in the zoo, on Cinco de Mayo, Puerto Rican Independence Day, this says Independence Day and such. We have to go beyond visibility to understanding, and we're not there yet.
Jesus Treviño.
All you need to do is look at local news. We have heard reports of the federal government sending camouflaged federal agents to Portland to infiltrate and arrest people, literally kidnapping people off the streets whom they think are troublemakers and are responsible for the riots. And without any identification of who they are or on what grounds people are being detained or kidnapped. And this, of course, is reminiscent of totalitarian societies where you don't have a say and where you don't have rights. And so in a way, what you see, what they're trying to do is portray those instances where, you know, there is confrontations or there is, you know, violence. And they're trying to basically paint the whole crowd with the same paintbrush and say this is happening throughout and therefore we have to come in and take over. And in many ways, this is reflective of how the sheriffs and LAPD in the aftermath of the moratorium march and riot were trying to portray the Latino community as the bad guys and justifying any actions that they did to bring down violence upon them.
Rosalio Munoz.
And these Gestapo-like attacks on demonstrations in Seattle and other places around the country that are they're promoting, it's deja vu all over again with a vengeance. And so those lessons we need to know about August 29th. most of my life, it's not been the August 29th as the main day to focus on. It's been different issues. And this year, it's November 3rd. And that's where we need a big turnout of people to change the direction of our country and in the White House and in the Senate. That's where the moratorium for me is. One of the best ways of doing that is registering, especially young people of all sorts, organizing to get people to vote by mail. That's where the mobilization is needed. So that's my focus on that. There's many ways that we should be celebrating our legacy of teaching our people's history and bringing it to people's attention. I hope I've been able to bring some attention to what was happening on August 29th. We kept on demonstrating. There kept on being much, much more infiltration and surveillance and intervention. At one point, there were people that came and said, in the name of the community, and ousted me as being too nonviolent after the moratorium. But later on, it was revealed that they were led by undercover agents.
Irene Tovar.
I've learned that in this country, under these rules now, if you don't speak up, you don't get anywhere. The other thing is that we got to be very persistent. I've been around a long, long time. As long as God gives me the strength, I will keep on trucking, as they say, okay? Because we're dealing with the dignity of human beings, okay? If we really believe either religiously or secular that we're valuable as human beings, then we have to play a role in ensuring that we dignify that body, that human being. What many started long before I was here, someone was battling for my rights. And I was able to get a little bit more than the previous generation because of them. And we hope that those of us that have been advocating that they remember that now they have an obligation to do the same for their next generation that will come after them.
The Chicano Moratorium March to Laguna Park, now Ruben Salazar Park, brought visibility to the issues affecting Latinos. But the police attacks overshadowed the activists' message of peace and social change. It shook up the community and disrupted the movement's momentum. It also propelled some Chicano activists to create works of art, to educate others, or to continue to fight for social change, while other Mexican-American journalists followed the path cut by Ruben Salazar. You've been listening to Frontline East LA, the Chicano Moratorium 50 Years Later. Special thanks to Yolanda Provost for allowing us to use excerpts of the film Requiem 29, directed by David Garcia and produced by Moctezuma Esparza. Special thanks also to Susan Racho for editorial assistance. The Making Contact team is Sonia Green, Lisa Redman, Anita Johnson, Salima Hamarani, Sabine Blazin, and I'm Monica Lopez. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.